Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Herald and Review dated Thursday, August 20th, 2026. We'll start with an article on the front page headlined, Decatur Public Schools, District Facing $4.3 Million Deficit. Operating Officer, Good Decisions and Hard Decisions Ahead, by Valerie Wells, Decatur. Decatur Public Schools is facing a budget deficit in the coming year. During Tuesday's board meeting, Chief Operational Officer Thomas Osborne told the board that the district's revenue for the coming year, based on a tentative budget presented for its approval, is $153.7 million over all funds, while expenditures total $158 million, leaving a deficit of $4.3 million. Considering only the education and operating funds, revenues total $133 million, with expenditures of $138.9 million, leaving a deficit there of $5.9 million. Osborne said that is the part of the budget that requires the most attention for the fiscal year 2027. Employees' salaries and benefits are the majority of expenditures, he said. Salaries total $71.9 million, and benefits, the fastest-growing major category, $24.7 million. While considering the tentative budget, he told the board, the priorities must be core instruction and student services. The only funds that the district can control are purchased services and supplies. We're going to have to make some good decisions and some hard decisions, he said. The education fund, which covers those salaries and benefits, has had to absorb some of the payments from other funds whose revenue was inadequate to meet the expenses, which means that with some expenses that can't be put off, health, life, safety improvements, for example, which have to be completed over the next 2 years, the district will use up reserves if changes aren't made. Board Vice President Will Wetzel encouraged the board to consider what Osborne said as the board prepares for the public hearing on the budget, scheduled for 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, September 22nd, when the final budget will come up for approval. During board discussion, board member Kevin Hale addressed the cancellation of the football season at Eisenhower High School, which will have a ripple effect on several other traditions and school activities. The marching band, who rehearsed in the hot weather with the hope of performing and raising money for a trip to Hawaii, will not be able to perform. Students won't have a homecoming game and the traditional parade and photos for the homecoming dance. The annual contest for best decorated hallway prior to the homecoming game will be lost. This fall, the press booth at Eisenhower was going to be dedicated to longtime broadcaster Scott Busboom, who died February 26, 2025, and called more than 1,200 high school games during his career. The activities are all wrapped around football season, said Hale, who broadcast games with Busboom and was a close friend. All those magical moments. The community loses the opportunity to gain traction from the positives that come from seeing students and facilities on display in a positive light. He's had phone calls and seen remarks on social media about the loss of the football season and all that goes with it, he said. A football season builds community, he said. And we hurt a family. We hurt the Busbooms. This was the year we were to dedicate the press box in his name. They are deeply hurt, and the way things were communicated was wrong, and we did not control the narrative. I think the superintendent has reached out to Mrs. Paula Busboom and let her know Scott was loved. FDA, U.S. ability to safeguard produce is limited, by Cassandra Garrison, Reuters. Mexico City. Two foodborne illness outbreaks linked to Taylor Farms exposed a weakness at the heart of North America's food system. The United States increasingly relies on Mexico's produce industry, and regulators are straining to oversee it to keep consumers safe. Taylor Farms, the $7 billion company that supplies fast food chains, major food distributors, and grocers, recalled prepared products containing jalapenos last week after U.S. authorities linked a salmonella outbreak that sickened several hundred people to peppers imported from Mexico. That followed a major cyclosporiasis outbreak traced to iceberg lettuce Taylor Farms imported from Mexico that sickened thousands and caused two deaths. The back-to-back incidents revived concerns about the Food and Drug Administration's ability to oversee imported food, experts say. The FDA's employment fell by 22% this year compared to 2024, according to agency data, in part due to workforce cuts since Donald Trump returned to the White House. Foreign food facility inspections by the FDA fell by almost 13% in fiscal 2025, while imports continued to rise. Without question, the cuts are harmful to food safety, said Jennifer McIntyre, founder of the U.S.-based food safety strategy consultancy, as is having decreased oversight to what's actually happening as outbreaks occur. The FDA did not respond to a request for comment. Reliance on Mexico. The U.S. imported less than $3 billion in agricultural products from Mexico in 1993, the year before the North American Free Trade Agreement took effect, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture data. That level increased by almost 1,500% through 2025. Mexico now accounts for more than 20% of all U.S. food imports, according to Luis Ribera, an agricultural economy expert at Texas A&M University. The U.S. imported $16.1 billion in fresh produce last year, according to a university analysis. We don't have to wait for products to be in season for us to consume it year-round, Ribera said. Having those partners is very important for the affordability of food here in the U.S. Yet the same supply chains that keep U.S. grocery shelves stocked also periodically expose consumers to foodborne illness. U.S. food safety investigations over the past two decades traced outbreaks to imported Mexican fruit and vegetables, including peppers, cantaloupes, cilantro, and leafy greens. The outbreaks prompted scrutiny of irrigation water, sanitation practices, and food safety controls across the fragmented networks of growers, packers, and distributors. The FDA imposed safeguards in some regions, though those exporters, growers, and processors in Mexico are already subject to U.S. food safety requirements. However, there is no uniform certification policy requiring all Mexican produce suppliers to demonstrate their irrigation water is safe before exporting to the U.S., experts said. Cristobal Chaidez, a researcher at Mexico's National Laboratory for Research in Food Safety, said agricultural water is a persistent vulnerability in fresh produce production in Mexico. During a drought, if a small farmer finds a water source, they might use it, even if it's poor quality, he said, adding that food companies ultimately bear responsibility for policing their supply chains. Import alerts. Taylor Farms temporarily shut down the Guanajuato processing facility that U.S. officials traced to the cyclosporiasis outbreak. In a statement, the company said its water sources are tested for fecal indicator organisms. We have cooperated fully with regulators in any instance where food safety concerns were raised, taking corrective action where warranted, the company said. The ongoing outbreak of cyclosporiasis was not the first linked to Taylor Farms in Mexico. In 2013, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention linked restaurant-associated illnesses in Iowa and Nebraska to a bagged salad mix from Taylor Farms in Guanajuato. Historically, the FDA responded to illness outbreaks by placing particular products and regions under import alerts. Firms that demonstrate compliance with additional safety, tracing, audit, and testing requirements may qualify for the agency's so-called green list and avoid being held at the border without needing inspection first. Yet, the green list system does not apply broadly across Mexican agriculture, and the twin outbreaks involving Taylor Farms and Mexican produce prompted questions about whether existing oversight tools are sufficient. McIntyre said import alerts and green lists generally are deployed after recurring problems emerge and serve as one enforcement tool rather than a standard requirement. I don't think that it is the be-all and end-all to produce safety, she said. It doesn't guarantee that there's still thorough understanding and execution of these practices. TV anchor named DPS Communications Chief by Valerie Wells, Decatur. WAND TV News anchor Alyssa Patrick has been named the new Director of Communications and Public Relations for Decatur Public Schools. Patrick is a graduate of Syracuse, New York University, with a bachelor's degree in broadcast and digital journalism, and has worked at WAND as a news reporter and anchor since 2021. She held similar positions previously at stations in El Paso, Texas, and Charleston, West Virginia. She will begin her new position on August 31st. Her initial contract will run through June 30th, 2027, with a prorated salary of $99,700 for the partial year, with a usual annual salary of $119,336 for a full year. The school district's fiscal year began on July 1st. Patrick's husband, Nick, is the weekday morning meteorologist at WAND, meaning that the couple work opposite shifts and long hours. I have two littles, she said. I have a 3- and a 1-year-old, and so my husband and I both work in TV, and it's a lot of long hours and late nights, and I'm really looking forward to being home for dinner time and bedtime every night, and just having a little more of a regular schedule, and hopefully getting a little more sleep. This is really going to be good for our family. And I'm in this realm and in this world, and I'm really excited to get to work with families and work with the district and with Dr. Nicole Nash Moody coming to work in the district. It got me really excited to come into the district at this time. Now with this new chapter in the district, and I'm really excited to work with her. The board unanimously approved her hiring at Tuesday's board meeting, and her approval was met with applause from those in attendance. I'm really honored to be accepting this position, she told the board. Many of you I've worked with and known, but for those who haven't, I'm a graduate of public education, both in elementary and in high school. I attended Syracuse University, and I've worked as a local journalist for over 12 years all over the country. And I've learned a lot. I'm hoping to take that expertise now and use it in this new role. Macon County Courts. Second defendant in sex trafficking case gets prison. By Tony Reed, Decatur. The second of two defendants who were accused of holding a former Mattoon woman captive in their Decatur apartment and forcing her to work as a prostitute has been sent to prison. Jacob D. Miller, 32, is now housed in the Graham Correctional Center, beginning a 4-year sentence. He took a plea deal in Macon County Circuit Court and admitted a charge of promoting prostitution. Presiding Judge Thomas Griffith then agreed to dismiss 3 counts of involuntary servitude involving the threat of physical harm, physical restraint, and financial harm. The judge also dismissed a charge of labor trafficking at the sentencing hearing July 27th and knocked 237 days off Miller's incarceration as credit for time spent in custody since his arrest in December of 2025. Miller's co-defendant, 37-year-old Brian M. Slater, is serving a 12-year sentence at the Big Muddy Correctional Center after taking his own plea deal and admitting a charge of involuntary servitude. Another judge, however, had ordered this sentence to run concurrently with an earlier 12-year sentence imposed in April, that Slater is serving for burglarizing the Mattoon home of the female victim's ex-husband. Sworn affidavits from law enforcement about the case said it was first exposed when Coles County Sheriff's Office investigators began a sex trafficking investigation. That probe was then joined by the Decatur-based Illinois Trafficking Enforcement Group, a specialist police task force formed to target sex slavery and other related crimes. Detectives said the female victim described being held captive for 2 weeks at the defendant's Decatur apartment. She said she was threatened that if she did not work as a prostitute, several pet dogs she had with her would be killed. She told police she earned around $3,000 from prostitution and was allowed to keep about $30, with Miller and Slater pocketing the rest. The woman also described being raped several times by both defendants, who told her they had to verify the merchandise, which was why they got to have sex with her whenever they wanted, according to one of the sworn affidavits. The woman appeared in court when Slater was sentenced July 23rd and gave a victim impact statement describing the emotional trauma she had suffered. Just before Slater was led out of court in shackles to go back to prison, she had told him, "I am now freed." Macon County Courts. Drug dealer, 62, gets 17 years in prison. By Tony Reed. Decatur. Nathaniel S. Devine, a 62-year-old convicted Decatur crack cocaine dealer, arrived at the Graham Correctional Center on August 7th to begin a 17-year sentence. Devine had taken a plea deal in Macon County Circuit Court that saw him admit to one charge of dealing the drug. But in return for the plea, further charges accusing him of being a felon in possession of a submachine gun and being a repeat felony offender armed with a firearm were dismissed by Judge Lindsay Shelton. Devine had been arrested September 30, 2025, after officers from the Decatur Police Department's Street Crimes Unit arrived at his home in the 1000 block of West Marietta Street with a search warrant. Officer Clayton Zills, who signed an affidavit detailing the raid, said Devine had been sitting on the front porch as police pulled up, but quickly retreated inside his house and locked the front door. The police introduced themselves by smashing it back open and seized 3 ounces of crack and powdered cocaine divided up in 36 plastic sandwich baggies. Zill said they also found a stolen .40-caliber handgun in Devine's bedroom, which had been fitted with a device known in street slang as a switch, turning it into a fully automatic weapon. Devine is quoted at first as claiming that drugs were only for his own use, but had trouble explaining the amount involved and its individual packaging. Detectives then stated to Devine that he sells cocaine, and Devine replied, "Every now and then." "Yeah," Zill said. Devine has an extensive criminal history, which includes a previous conviction for armed robbery out of Peoria County. In 1989, in Macon County, he was sentenced to 8 years in prison for a conviction of dealing in cocaine. Passing sentence at a hearing July 17th, Judge Shelton said, "The court further finds that the offense was committed as a result of the use of, abuse of, or addiction to alcohol or a controlled substance and recommends the defendant for placement in a substance abuse program." Devine also got 9 months knocked off his sentence to compensate for time spent in custody since his arrest. He will earn day-for-day credit while incarcerated and is due to be paroled on March 30th, 2034. Immigration, Illinois, where dreams feel protected. 97 new U.S. citizens take oath of allegiance in Chicago ceremony. By Maggie Dougherty, Capital News, Illinois, Chicago. 97 new citizens from 34 countries swore allegiance to the U.S. at a ceremony Tuesday in the Dirksen Federal Courthouse. The group of new citizens is substantially smaller than the nearly 1,000 who were sworn in at Wrigley Field this time last year, and it's representative of a broader trend. According to numbers provided by the U.S. District Court For the Northern District of Illinois, the court administered fewer than 4,500 naturalizations in the first 7 months of the year. That's roughly a quarter of the 16,580 it averaged for the same period over each of the last 4 years, and down over 75% from this time last year. Over 300 more new citizens are expected to be naturalized at the State Fair in Springfield on Wednesday. Edward Yonka, Director of Communications and Public Policy for the ACLU of Illinois, said that reduction is no accident, but rather the outcome of a deliberate design by the Trump administration. The administration has nearly gutted the existing legal pathways to citizenship, all while it actively tries to denaturalize people who have lived in and contributed to the United States for decades, Yonka said in an email to Capital News Illinois. This reflects a reckless disregard for our national history and tradition, and for the positive economic and cultural impact that new citizens bring to our communities. The administration's blind loathing of immigrants is doing harm to our nation that will take decades to repair. The naturalization exam saw major revisions under the federal administration last October, when it expanded the pool of potential questions, shift to a greater emphasis on U.S. history and the Constitution, and increase the number of correct answers required to pass up to 12 out of 20 from the previous requirement for 6 out of 10. A policy memorandum issued last August also instituted a new holistic assessment requiring citizenship candidates to demonstrate good moral character through positive societal contributions, rather than just the absence of a criminal record. In a statement, U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services spokesperson Zach Kaller said the change is reflective of a shift from the Biden administration, which he alleged prioritized rubber stamping applications with minimal vetting. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, under the leadership of President Trump, is implementing rigorous screening and vetting processes across the country, Kaller said. USCIS will not take shortcuts in the naturalization process. But for the 97 new citizens, it was a day of celebration. American dreams. Josu Carranza, 26, came to the U.S. 12 years ago from his home country of Honduras. Though he said Honduras is a good country, Carranza said America provided more opportunities. This is the country for your dreams to come true, he said. To start a new life in a country where my rights and my dreams, they feel protected. Carranza, now a FedEx driver, dreams of opening a construction business and is currently studying for a masonry exam, a passion he developed through years of walking Chicago's streets and looking up at its historic brick buildings. To open a business in Honduras would not have been possible for him, he said, due to gang violence and threats from criminal organizations. Now he'll sit for his masonry exam in October. For Maria de Los Angeles Marufa, 49, becoming a citizen is all about getting the right to vote. When she came to the U.S. from Mexico 3 decades ago, De Los Angeles Marufo said she was single and looking for a better future. Now, her 3 adult children are grown, and it's time to do something for herself, she said. Becoming a U.S. citizen was part of that journey. I feel so blessed that I have this opportunity to become a citizen, De Los Angeles Marufo said. Now I have the opportunity to vote, so my voice is going to be heard. I'm so happy to be here. Beyond filling out her application to vote in November, De Los Angeles Marufa is planning to go back to school to become a teacher's aide after working as a manager at Popeyes for nearly 20 years. She loves kids and wants to help them grow, she said. Father-daughter pair Sandeep and Anishka Dutta, 59 and 23 respectively, moved to the U.S. from India 12 years ago. The naturalization ceremony was emotional, they said. It's a feeling of loss and gain, Sandeep Dutta said. You know, we just gave up something. We got something new. There's an emotion which I can't explain. His daughter said she enjoyed the welcoming theme of the ceremony. I really liked that it was bringing together everything that you have in your life, your family, your ancestry, whatever it may be, and bringing it to America, Anishka Dutta said. I really like that sentiment because it makes me feel like I may be giving something up, but I'm not giving up who I am. Illinois hunting. Applications taken for upland game pheasants by Brendan Sanders, Jacksonville Journal Courier, Illinois. Hunting season is on the horizon for Illinois, and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources is now accepting applications for the 2026 Free Upland Game Hunting Permit Lottery and the Controlled Pheasant Hunting Program. Applications for the Free Upland Game Hunting Permit Lottery will be accepted through August 31st. Hunters can select up to 6 hunt areas and 4 dates for each area using the online application. Applicants may list the same hunt area multiple times to improve their chances of receiving preferred hunting dates. The Free Upland Game Hunting Permit Program offers lottery-assigned, no-cost hunting opportunities for wild upland game, including bobwhite quail, ring-necked pheasants, and cottontail rabbits. The Controlled Pheasant Hunting Program is a fee-based program that offers opportunities to hunt pen-reared ring-necked pheasants released at participating state sites. These programs provide opportunities to hunt at select state sites across Illinois this fall. The Controlled Pheasant Hunting Program includes 3 lottery drawings, followed by a first-come, first-served permit period. Youth permits primarily will be available during the first-come, first-served period, and additional wing shooting clinics are being added to select youth pheasant hunts. A complete list of youth clinics will be announced at a later date. The remaining application periods for the program are third lottery for residents and non-residents seeking a second permit. Applications are accepted from 3 p.m. Monday, August 17th through 1 p.m. Monday, August 24th. First come, first serve permits. Available beginning at 8 a.m. Saturday, August 29th until quotas are filled or until 9 a.m. the day before the scheduled hunt. Disabled hunter permits remain available until allocated permits are exhausted or until midnight 2 days before the applicable hunt date. Hunters can find participating sites, permit rules, application instructions, and application status information on the IDNR Upland Game Hunting webpage. Resident permits cost $35 and non-resident permits are $40. 11 Illinois state parks participate in the Controlled Pheasant Hunting Program. Applications, program information, and participating site details are available on the IDNR Controlled Pheasant Hunting webpage. We'll take a break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review dated Thursday, August 20th, 2026. Please stay tuned.